You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 229 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
This feels weird.
It does. It feels very weird.
We are currently sitting around my fire pit in the backyard, distanced, of course. This is the first time that the Fabulous Pelton Brothers have recorded a podcast in person since February.
We did it in March. We did it very early in March, but it's been over 6 months.
We did a Talkin' Taco Time on March 1st.
No, we recorded the Pelton Cast the next day before I flew to Boston.
So, you came over to my house?
I did.
No, you didn't.
Yeah.
I let you into my house?
The last time I've been in your house besides to go to the bathroom.
Really?
Yes. So, yeah, it's been a while. And I don't think this is going to be a routine because normally it is not going to be this warm and clear at night in Seattle going forward. But
This is the first time that we've recorded a podcast outside since we recorded that podcast at Loretta's like 7 years ago.
No, I think we recorded one on your patio one time at the old house, didn't we? I think it's been done. Anyways, that's probably not your foremost concern here. We should get to what we're drinking this week because fresh hop season continues. Even though it's technically fall, fresh hop season continues. And we have this week, I don't know how I'm going to read the bottle, Fremont's Koichi Canyon Pale Ale.
Hello! This is an important one. Hold on. I've got a flashlight.
Okay. My phone is a flashlight.
Okay. Here we are. We are a family-owned craft brewery founded in 2009 to brew artisan beers.
That said, all the Fremont beers say that. You got to do the Koichi Canyon specific stuff.
Koichi Canyon. It's only like one sentence. I was basically done. Koichi Canyon Fresh Hop Ale is brewed with select hops grown in the Koichi Canyon of the Yakima Valley, which are harvested and placed into our kettle within 24 hours, creating a unique once-a-year beer. We make Koichi Canyon Ale in partnership with hop-growing wizards from the Yakima Valley in an effort to expand the hop industry in Washington State because hops matter. A portion of all sales from the Koichi Canyon Conservancy, a portion of all sales fund the Koichi Canyon Conservancy. There we go. I made it through that.
All right. We've got here Mosaic, Citra, and Equinot.
Oh, yeah.
Fresh organic hops. Aroma, orange and mango dominate, followed by some melon, berry, and pine notes, and a flavor, light sweetness and moderately bitter with medium body and carbonation. This is a delicacy. I don't know what the right word is, but it's hard to come by.
Oh, the hops. They're fresh.
They are, as far as I can tell, all sold out at Fremont of this currently. I was able
really?
To pick some up at Total Wine. I had to call them to check, and they said, we've got 2 6-packs, and that's
did
it.
Did you get both?
No, I didn't want to be greedy.
Wow, that's generous of you.
It is.
This is like, the Field of Ferment is the more mainstream fresh hop ale. This is the indie one.
This is the connoisseur's fresh hop ale.
Yes, this is a tasting fresh hop ale, right?
That's actually appropriate because we're about to talk about the thinking fans, Seahawks.
The thinking fans.
That's going to come up during this conversation.
Before we get there, though, I think another toast is in order. Before we toast to Pacific Northwest football legend Jermaine Kearse. This has been a big week on Seahawks Twitter.
It has.
And, you know, the Let Russ Cook movement has been going mainstream over the last few weeks.
What's bigger than mainstream?
And this is freaking, this is Marvel levels, right? Like,
the Seahawks Twitter cinematic universe is a scary thought.
This is Avengers Endgame for the Let Russ Cook movement, and Zach Whitman, third Pelton brother, the decider now, ESPN's Zach Whitman.
Yes, ESPN celebrity.
ESPN celebrity Zach Whitman.
Zach Whitman. Yeah, being featured on NFL Countdown on a segment hosted by Third Pelton brother Mina Kimes. What a moment. And then not only that, following up on that, getting a shout out on Twitter from Josh Gordon for having Free Josh Gordon be his Twitter username is pictured during that segment. So it's been a big week for Seahawks players tweeting people, Third Pelton brothers, I guess.
You know how I know that Zach is now famous?
How do you know that?
It's because he changed his Twitter handle from Free Josh Gordon
to Zach,
Zach Whitman.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, okay. You've reached a new level of fame that you can't have a joke Twitter name anymore.
And then also, I'm pretty sure since we last podcast was the Athletic Seattle's recap history of the Let Russ Cook movement, which also, of course, quoted Zach and featured DJ Infrared. So it was definitely inspired by the segment we did during the live show. All right, now are we going to toast to curse?
All right.
There it is. A toast from afar.
We'll talk a little bit more about this in a second with Third Pelton brother Natalie Weiner. But just such an amazing career from beginning to end for Jermaine Kearse. It was a pleasure to have watched him play over this last decade plus in Seattle.
Undoubtedly. Here's to you, Jermaine.
It's a bittersweet day because we've seen the departure, the end of the career for a legend, not only for the Seahawks, but specifically, I would say, in the hearts of the Pelton cast, with Jermaine Kearse announcing his retirement. And, of course, there was no one else we could have join us to talk about this. But I think the ringleader of the Kearse crew, right? Is that fair?
I think so. It's funny. My mom actually asked me that question. She was like, did you start the Kearse crew? I was like, yes, I definitely started. Like, it wasn't a thing. It's not a thing. It's just, it's a thing that I tweet, you know? So, yeah, I started it.
You started something that's not a thing. Anyway, that's of course Natalie Weiner. We welcome back as Third Pelton brother to discuss this. Yeah, you were able to process this earlier because Jermaine announced his retirement fairly early, and I woke up, I would say, to the news, and specifically to him tweeting you to thank you for your support over the year, which was well deserved.
I mean, it was so sweet and, like, obviously not what I expected. Like, you know, I don't really tag people in my tweets. You know, I sort of feel like that's gauche. Like, I don't want to annoy famous people. But I saw his Instagram post, you know, because, of course, I follow him on Instagram. And I was like, oh, my God, this is like I'm actually like emotional about this. You know, it wasn't something I had obviously given a lot of thought to, like, when will Kearse retire? But I was like, oh, like, I'm sad. You know, it really does feel like the end of an era. And so I was like tweeting about it, and then I guess like he does follow me on Twitter, so maybe he like saw something I tweeted, I guess, and then he like tweeted that nice message at me. He said I was simply the best. I was like, okay, well, thank you, Kearse. Like, I was not expecting that kind of compliment. It's very kind of you.
You think he doesn't know about the Kearse crew? I mean, come on.
I mean, I think he did follow me back at some point, so I knew he had like some awareness that I was like advocating for his skills, but yeah, I didn't realize it was that deep, you know?
I mean, certainly this is something I had thought was a possibility. He suffered that horrific injury last year during preseason with the Detroit Lions. Wasn't with the team in training camp this year, so you never knew if he was going to pop up somewhere mid-season. The Seahawks love those kind of, you know, to bring back their former players in that kind of role. But, you know, it's been a tremendous NFL career for someone who went undrafted out of UW, 7 years in the league, 8 if you count last year on IR for the Lions, 99 games, 255 catches for 3,290 yards, 17 touchdowns, but
yeah,
that doesn't really tell the story because those are regular season stats. And the real story is that Jermaine Kearse has 6 playoff touchdowns to his name, including each NFC Championship game the Seahawks appeared in and Super Bowl 48. This was the biggest game of all big game players.
Yeah, I mean, like, just clutch. Classic. I mean, Kearse, clutch, catch. You know, you can't say the acronym there because then it gets bad, but it does all sound like it goes together. And yeah, I just feel like, I mean, the magic of Curse is that, like, everybody talks so much shit about him constantly because, like, he would do some goofy things occasionally. Like, I can admit that. But, like, you know, he did come through in important moments. And I just remember, like, once when everybody was, like, clowning on Curse for something, like, I, like, DM'd Bob Condotta, you know, who I, like, sort of have gotten to know over this course of sports media Seahawksness, and, like, we were just talking about Curse, and he was like, yeah, people don't get it, like, Russ really loves Curse and he really trusts him, and, like, that's why he gets those targets in those clutch moments, is because, like, regardless of if he, like, drops something at some point, you know, like, Russell still ultimately trusts him, and, like, he's always showing up, you know, in all the cliche ways, like, prepared to practice, blah blah blah, but, like, you know, Bob said this was like an off the record conversation, and Bob was like, that stuff's really true with him, and that's why he's stuck around.
You don't make it as an undrafted rookie unless you're doing all those things. And yeah, I mean, it was strange because statistically Curse was so good in odd numbered years and often very ineffective in even number of years, including 2016, his last year when he caught only 46% of his targets sent his way for 5.7 yards per target, after the previous season catching 72% of targets for 10.1 yards per target. Like, that is oscillating wildly. I think before 2015, was that the LASIK surgery?
Yeah, I didn't know about his LASIK surgery. I was just reading Bob's article. That makes me laugh so much. Like, relatable king, like, bad eyesight, you know, like, who among us doesn't, you know, need some LASIK?
one of us on this podcast had to finally succumb and start wearing glasses within the past month here.
Wait, who?
That was Tristan. I've been wearing them since.
You wouldn't be shocked to learn that Kevin Belton has been wearing glasses from a very
since
young age.
1990.
Wow. As though I too have not also been wearing glasses from a young age. Like, there's nothing wrong with that.
The LASIK surgery was when he came into the NFL, though. This was 2012 season, as far as I understand, because there was an issue. You mentioned the odd year. Even year discrepancy. He had a monster season his junior year of college, which was an even year at UW, going for over 1,000 yards at 16 yards per catch, and then had a pretty big down year in his senior year. That's why he needed to get LASIK surgery after that season. I mean, he would have been first round draft pick otherwise.
Just his eyes, you know, failing him. But,
okay, so
yeah, I don't know. Oh, what were you going to say?
I think a couple of questions. First off, wanted to pose the question, consider the question of where Curse ranks among the all-time great Husky Seahawks. There has been 29 Huskies who have played for the Seahawks all-time, according to the Seahawks.com all-time roster. Not sure if there's been any added to the list this season that might be missing, but there's obviously, like Warren Moon is the best of these players. Lawyer Malloy is the next best of these players. But those guys didn't play a substantial period of time as Seahawks. Their best moments didn't come as Seahawks. I think there is, like, Curse has a more reasonable case than you'd think. His competition, Blair Bush started several seasons, six seasons at center for the Seahawks. He was a part of the late 70s, early 80s Husky teams, so a little bit before our time, certainly, to remember him. Jeremy Stevens was with the Seahawks a long time. He certainly was a long time. Michael Jackson, starting for many seasons at middle linebacker for the Seahawks in the 80s. And then Paul Scanzi had kind of similar career stats to Curse as a receiver, primarily in the late 80s. So those I think are your main candidates for best Seahawks as Husky or former Huskies as Seahawks.
And I'm noting that this roster looks like it hasn't been updated since the 2017 season, so it doesn't include Will Dissly or Ben Burkhurst.
There you go.
Okay, well, Will Dissly has a ways to go before we can put him in the curse. What's the word
pantheon?
I'm looking for? Oh my god, yeah, I mean curse pantheon. Yeah, we can't even speak their names in the same sentence, really. But I mean, I feel like I, with all due respect to those esteemed members of this unique little group, like, I feel like Curse has to be near the top. I mean, specifically for Seattle relevance, and also like the way that his play is kind of defined an era of the Seahawks, like the best era of the Seahawks, yep. kind of inarguably. I mean, given that it led to a Super Bowl title and another Super Bowl tragic visit, you know? I mean, like, he is an indispensable part. And also, like, attitude wise, just the whole like pedestrian receiver thing. I mean, he was so emblematic of that like mentality that the Seahawks were underdogs and, you know, we're going to win in unorthodox ways and stuff. You know, who's more doing that than Curse?
Okay, the other thing I wanted to bring up, by the way.
Well, no, before then, you have to just look at magnitude. And that's the real magic of Jermaine Curse. Like, we love Jermaine Curse because of just getting to know him through over the years, right? And his, like we've talked about, like his consistent showing up, doing the little things. But the Seahawks have been to the Super Bowl 3 times in their history. And 2 of those times, Jermaine Curse had the catch that sent them there. Like, there's nobody else in Seahawks history who can come even close to having right. plays on that same magnitude.
Right. No, when push came to shove, you know, who was there? It was Curse, you know, regardless of what the haters say, you know, like, I don't even know. But yeah, I think you've got to have him on the podcast. He's got free time now. So,
well, Jermaine Curse, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the podcast. Get at us, tweet us.
Maybe I could DM yeah. him now that I remember that he follows me. he might be a little weirded out though.
Okay, so Tristan's discussion naturally segues us to our other question, which is first off, a list here: Seahawks career playoff touchdowns. Number 1, Marshawn Lynch with 12. Number 2, Sean Alexander with 8. Number 3 is a tie between Doug Baldwin and Jermaine Curse with 6.
Yeah.
There we go.
So
that's the good stuff.
I think there's probably an obvious answer to what is the single greatest Jermaine Curse moment and catch. It probably has to be the 2014 NFC Championship game in overtime. A perfect pass by Russell Wilson to win that game, to complete that amazing comeback. But, I mean, I don't know if we want to go through, like, a top 3 or top 5, but other top Jermaine Curse moments, including the game, what proved to be the game-winning touchdown the previous year against San Francisco much earlier in that NFC Championship game.
There's so many, you know, it's hard to pick. I feel like just like any time that he caught it and everyone was like, why is Russell throwing to Curse? And I was like, because Curse is going to catch it, be there for him. Anytime I got to be right on Twitter, basically, that's my favorite Curse moment. And he gave me a lot of opportunities to do that. So, you know, thanks, Jermaine.
Tristan.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of that aspect of Curse being kind of the deep threat, the initial deep threat for Russell Wilson early on in his career. I mean, there was a ball, I want to say, down the sideline to beat Carolina earlier on.
That was his right? first career touchdown, was the opening game of the 2013 season. And one of the reasons that play really stands out is it was kind of a fascinating situation where I have to look up the Seahawks roster to even remember the name of the other receiver. But there was someone else who was the big hot receiver.
Braylon Edwards.
No, it was not Braylon Edwards. The big hot receiver in training camp. And
Terrell Owens?
No. It was I guess this person did not even have a catch, as it turned out. Maybe I'm misremembering this. But I think there was like back-to-back deep balls. And the one of them was incomplete. And then the second play, they went right back to the same thing, and this time it was Curse, and he caught what was the only touchdown of that game, the score that made the difference in that thrilling 12-7 Seahawks victory. and that was kind of the moment, like, is the start of the season that became the Seahawks Super Bowl season. It was Steven Williams was the receiver who had the big training camp and did not, in fact, catch a pass. He was targeted twice, and that was it.
the wow. legacy of Williams receivers, Kasen he's Williams. Been,
like, he's been like eternal sunshine from our brains, I feel. Like, Stephen Williams. You said that name, and there was not a ding of like, oh yeah.
What about Chris Matthews? Does that ring a bell?
Oh, okay. Absolutely. Chris Matthews, Super Bowl hero.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the serving the notice that Jermaine Kearse is just going to make big plays and score touchdowns when it matters most. And the other thing that stands out is Jermaine Kearse responsible for perhaps the all-time greatest Pelton cast regret? I've mentioned this before, but during the first year of the Pelton cast, our first incarnation covering the 2013 Super Bowl season, we sponsored the Jermaine Kearse page on Pro Football Reference, which got us, like, I think 2 clicks all time. We were, like, really hoping that once he's, you know, a hero in the NFC Championship game, scores a touchdown in the Super Bowl, this is going to be our ticket to celebrity, Jermaine Kearse.
And nobody ever did. Wow. Yeah. That's because, you know what, lamestream media will not acknowledge the greatness of Jermaine Kearse.
But the fact that we didn't get the clicks isn't the regret. The regret is, so then we stopped recording the podcast for a period of time. We let that sponsorship lapse because there was no Pelton cast to link to. And then Pro Football Reference decided to take away sponsorship. So everyone, but they grandfathered in the ones that were remaining. So we could still be there on the Jermaine Kearse page today.
Wow. No.
If only we had kept up the sponsorship.
Oh my God. Wow. That is a major regret. I understand.
So.
But, you know, it wasn't meant to be. Only the real heads will know. Jermaine was always meant to be kind of a niche favorite, you know? He's not supposed to be, like, people, you don't want it to get too out there, you know? He's the hip, the thinking man's Seahawks wide receiver of all time, you know?
And as far as adding to individual plays, too, I have to mention the Super Bowl 49 right. catch that he had. I mean, he didn't have another game-winning touchdown, but that play, you know, as it were, before everything that happened, he had the most important play of the game to that point.
For sure.
Going and getting that bobbled catch, scooping it up off the ground, the ball, like, being on his chest. You know, Kearse, for a game that was very forgettable in many ways, still had this amazing play in such a huge moment, similar to what he had done in basically every other playoff game before then.
Like, imagine if Russ had just targeted Kearse in the end zone. You know, I'm just going to put that out there. Mm-hmm. Like, things might have ended differently.
And the Seahawks probably will always wonder about including him in the Sheldon Richardson trade. And then he goes on in that season in 2017 while playing with Josh McCown to have the most productive season of his career, catching 65 yeah. passes for 810 yards and 5 touchdowns with the New York Jets. So
that was also great for me as far as, like, being vindicating. And then he was in New York, you know? I actually, like, I remember, like, seeing his locker in the locker room, because at that point I was, like, going over to the Jets locker room sometimes. But I never, like, talked to him, sadly. I felt like that would be weird. But yeah, no, it was a good run. You know, some of us have to do the switch, the Seattle to New York shuttle. It's just Jermaine and I, you know.
Also, the catch in the Super Bowl, just how that happened with him spinning out of 2 defenders and then spinning out of another tackle and getting to the end zone. Like, Jermaine Kearse just freaking shows up in these
after
games.
You had Nostra Tristan that he was going to score a touchdown in the Super Bowl. That was, as I recall it, one of your bold predictions for calendar 2014.
This was when we were deciding to sponsor the page. That's when the clicks were going to start rolling in when Kearse scored the touchdown in the Super Bowl. So.
Wow. I think that's, like, probably fair to say that you were the original Kearse crew members then, and I just gave it a name, you know? Like, because I was definitely on board a little later.
Well, here's the thing. We've been on board the Kearse crew since his freshman year in college. And right. I feel like Jermaine Kearse, more than almost anybody, you know, mentioned these other Huskies, the Seahawks. Like, yes, Warren Moon is both a great Husky and a great Seahawk. Laura Malloy was both a great Husky and played for the Seahawks. Paul Scanzi, I don't really know that much about. But Jermaine Kearse, as somebody who is so Pacific Northwest football, as somebody who played high school at Lakes High School, went to UW, had an excellent 4 years at UW, you know, culminating in this junior year where he goes for over 1,000 yards, and is kind of there as the team is going from being laughing stock to transforming the culture at UW to sort of what it is now and being a competitive football program. Then being undrafted by the Seahawks, having to fight and work his way onto the team in a fairly deep receiving core at that time. You know, there's still Doug Baldwin and Golden Tate on that roster. He beat out Terrell Owens in training camp. Braylon Edwards is there.
Sidney Rice.
Like Sidney Rice, this was not a weak group of receivers. And this undrafted rookie beat out all of those receivers to make the team. And then after that, to continue to grow and develop this relationship with Russ through that time period, to build up this trust that you're talking about, Natalie, and to be able to take that and elevate the Seahawks to the highest moments that they've ever been to in their franchise history. All of this on the back of an undervalued, an unknown receiver from the Pacific Northwest, not on the radar for any team in the NFL draft, but he is out there beating the Green Bay Packers to go to the Super Bowl, beating the San Francisco 49ers to go to the Super Bowl. And I don't think there's anybody who is more emblematic of Northwest football than Jermaine Kearse.
Wow. That was beautiful.
It was poetic. And that's why, you know, I think today I know that you and Barnwell both said you were crying about the news, but I choose not to cry because it's over, but to smile because it happened.
Okay, Kevin.
Is Seahawks Twitter status.
Oh, yeah. No, Bill, I was supposed to make Bill a Kearse Crew shirt, and I just never did because it was really hard to make the first one. So I put it off.
Yeah, that's one of one T-shirt.
Yeah, one of one. He did. He actually gave me a shirt to like iron the thing onto, and I just never did it. So sorry, Bill.
Well, on that note, thanks so much for joining us to talk about the Kearse Crew and Jermaine Kearse's career, Natalie. We saw a great feature. If you haven't seen it, be sure to check it out. You did a great feature on Sue Bird last week in the New York Times ahead of the WNBA Finals.
I did. Yes, definitely check it out. She is another Seattle legend. You know, where are the Jermaine Kearse and Sue Bird statues in downtown Seattle? This is my question. But yeah, no, that's great. And thank you for having me on. It's an honor to talk about a hero like Kearse.
Thanks so much for joining us.
All right, having discussed Jermaine Kearse's retirement, it's time to get to our Seattle food update. Not a big one this week, but something exciting happening for
Presented
you.
Presented by our good friends at Pagliacci.
Yes.
I love how off we are that we're in person. We've reverted back to March levels of podcasting.
Why?
Everything we've learned in those past 6 months is gone.
That implies that we've gotten better since March. So exciting developments for you here in Renton.
Oh, yes. This is huge. You know, we mentioned Zach a moment ago, and one of the things that Zach told us on the live Peltoncast a few weeks ago was that we should be thanking the East Side for their food contributions to the city of Seattle. And one of those biggest contributions that the East Side has made to the city of Seattle is teriyaki, of course. I would assume we didn't go to any of them. But that is Dozone in particular. Maybe the most important food contribution that the East Side has ever given to the world. Opening in Renton, finally. Let's go.
At the Landing. You have not had soup dumplings that close to you, at least like high quality soup dumplings.
Well, the Mama Dough is pretty close.
That's true, yeah.
So
it's actually closer than the Landing.
Yeah, but I have not had Cubao this close.
That is true.
Yes, so this is huge, and we are going to feast on these dumplings.
As soon as you actually can manage to get a call in and place an order.
One other bit of housekeeping from the live show. Anybody who we promised a hat to who won bingo, who we promised a hat to. Otherwise, you now gave me the hats today.
I did. So make sure that we have your addresses.
They will. I think we have all the addresses. Okay. Mrs. Fantasy Genius being in charge of the mailing for the Pelton cast.
She is, yes. Not a strong suit of the Pelton brothers.
No, no.
The other thing I wanted to mention in the Seattle Food Update, a place I went today that I have not been in all of calendar 2020, and
wow,
that is a mistake, Pecos Pit Barbecue,
mm-hmm,
a longtime favorite. We've discussed it. We discussed it in the taco slash burrito search in particular, I think, because of the fact that that was one of the contenders. I chose not to get the burrito today because it had been so long. I had to go with the classic Pecos beef sandwich.
Yeah, you got to go with the barbecue sandwich.
The old standby, the old faithful. I was also, had been thinking about it for a while because seeing Weebe, as I'm going through my Wire rewatch, mm-hmm, as the listener knows, or not rewatch, watch.
Mm-hmm.
Weebe, they're confessing to all the crimes he's committed, and he only has one request, and that's to get him that pit beef sandwich. So, much the same. I feel the same way about the pit beef sandwich. It is the end of an era in some ways at Pecos, because there was a sign up indicating that after 40 years, having started Pecos in 1980, the couple of Ron and Deborah Wise, who brought it to Seattle, are finally retiring after previously selling the franchise rights to Jerry Klingon, who has started the one in West Seattle and other locations that are growing throughout the Seattle area.
Are they? Where are the other locations?
Let me scroll over to the location.
And so they were still running the home location?
Correct.
The Soto location?
Yeah, and, you know,
is that particular location going to be continuing with Jerry Klingon? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, someone asked about that before I got there in line, and they made it very clear that nothing's changing, just that that couple is retiring, stepping down from actively. And, like, if you went to Pecos as regularly as I have for the past 15 or so years here, you know, Deborah would be the person who would be serving you quite frequently when you went up to order, and, you know, very friendly to the customers. You got to know everybody. It was just a great time.
Weebe said he wanted a pit beef sandwich. I do not remember that at all.
He specifically, the conversation, I think he's eating a pit beef sandwich in the interrogation room. And he asks for, I forget what the side he asks for. He's told they don't have it. They only have something else. And it's a huge disappointment to him. But he wanted the pit beef.
Uh-huh.
And they go for it previously in the first season. the other location that is currently open is that they have the Pike's Pit in the Market.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they list coming soon North Seattle and Federal Way.
So, North Seattle and Federal Way?
Yeah, location on Aurora in the 143rd block, nearly Shoreline. So
interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll see when or if those happen. But Pecos, the other thing I wanted to mention is they're now offering ribs. And
really?
They offer it in as small as the quarter rack of ribs, which seemed reasonable to go along with the pit beef sandwich.
It's not, but it seemed reasonable.
Oh, I was already at it. I gotta say, though, I don't know if I would recommend the ribs.
Really?
I think stick to the pit beef. They're very good at that. So there you go.
Huh, okay.
And someday we're going to search for Seattle's best barbecue. I look forward to that. Let's get to sports, starting with the Seattle Mariners, whose season concluded on Sunday with a 27. We're pouring one out for the Mariners 2020 season, such as it was.
RIP. Just really a majestic season.
Games canceled due to smoke. Games canceled due to positive tests among other organizations. But you know who never had a positive COVID test?
There we go.
Your Seattle Mariners.
You know what? They didn't make the playoffs. They didn't get a good draft pick, but no positive tests.
They finished two games back of the Houston Astros for second in the AL West, and their minus 49 run differential ranked 12th of the 15 AL teams. So I've seen a few takes that are like, you know, the Mariners showed this year, they're close, they need to add some veterans to go to these young players to take the next step, and it's like, let's all remain calm. They got really lucky in terms of winning close games in a shortened season during a pandemic.
What a shock that you're there to say let's all remain calm when people are excited about something.
You know, just call me Mr. Raid on your parade.
but this was a colossal failure of a season. The exciting thing is the development of Kyle Lewis. Like, the Mariners seem like they have a homegrown offensive star for, I mean, I guess Kyle Seager could be somebody like that. But it seems like Kyle Lewis's potential exceeds even Kyle Seager's. He could be the first homegrown offensive star since the 90s, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so. It's been a while.
So that's you. And also just an exciting baseball player.
Kenny Raul Ibanez is a homegrown star.
Sure.
They grew him. And then he went elsewhere and became good and then came back. But
I don't know if that counts. But also, Raul Ibanez was part of, like, what year are we talking? 1998 or something? Like,
we came back to the team more recently. Yeah, also, I hope that Kyle Lewis is better than Raul Ibanez.
But just having an exciting baseball player to watch is really something. Look, most very good teams don't have an exciting baseball player to watch.
True.
So that's definitely something. In every other way, the season was a colossal failure. But having Kyle Lewis was a major win.
By the way, this Kawichi Canyon is outstanding.
Oh, my God.
So good. There's a reason it's in such demand. Seattle Sounders got a 3-1 win on Sunday at the LA Galaxy, playing without Raul Ruiz Diaz, who missed the match with a one-game suspension for violent conduct after tripping Pablo Bonilla in the Portland match. The MLS Disciplinary Committee upgraded the yellow card that Ruiz Diaz was handed during the game via VAR, but the Sounders did not need him.
There we go.
Taking advantage of the Galaxy's attempt to play an offside trap using a high line to repeatedly get in behind the defense, particularly Jordan Morris, who set up Christian Roland for the first goal and then scored off an incredible cross-field feed from Nico Lodero to get him in space for the second goal.
Now, why did they continue this strategy?
Same reason San Jose continued their man marking strategy against the Sounders in the 7-1 loss they had at Century League Field.
At some point, you're just like, what are we going to do? We can't change things that quickly.
As I joked on Twitter, it was some Galaxy brain thinking from LA. Roldan added the third goal 1v1 with the keeper. He got in behind the defense after halftime. The Sounders did give up a goal late. It's Roldan's fifth and sixth goals career versus the Galaxy, his most versus any opponent.
Wow. Do you think the offside trap is the soccer strategy that fans hate the most?
I thought what you were going to say, and I will instead say it, it's the soccer strategy equivalent of the goal line phase.
That's exactly what I was going to say, yes.
Good, we're on the same page.
So I was getting there, but it's basically like people keep doing it. It never seems to be successful.
I mean, it must succeed at some point.
There must be some logic to it, but maybe it's just like so highlighted when it's bad, or it's so bad when it's bad. Maybe you don't even notice it when it's good.
Exactly. The victory for the Sounders kept pace with Portland atop the Western Conference. The Sounders still have one match in hand compared to the Timbers and are now given almost a 60% chance of finishing first in the conference by Soccer Power Index on 5/30.
There we go.
And they will be going for first in the West with an old friend back. And I don't mean Brad Smith, who made his Sounders re-debut in Sunday's match coming off the bench. Instead, on Monday, they traded a conditional first-round pick to Inter Miami to bring back Roman Torres.
It's wild. They're kind of the Seahawks in the MLS.
There's some elements of that. I mean, the Seahawks would probably read the market better than let Roman Torres walk during free agency and then possibly trade a first-round pick to get him back 6 months later.
That was lightning fast. The Seahawks have not done anything like that.
This is the Seahawks trading a first-round pick to get Jadeveon Clowney in midseason.
I wouldn't be shocked. But right, there have been a number of players who have come and gone.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, Lamar Nagel was here and gone like three times at least.
Still waiting for you to come back, Sabala, too.
there's still time. When the Sounders let Torres go during the offseason, part of their logic was that, you know, they were planning to bring in another center back, and they did with Yaimer Gomez Andrade, who has worked out, I think, just fine for them in the back, but they were counting on Javier Arriaga to step in as a full-time starter, and that has not gone just fine. Mm-hmm. That has gone very poorly, although he did play somewhat successfully in this Galaxy match. He seems to be at his best generally against the LA teams. And struggles against everyone else.
Start him then. Is Roman Torres good?
He's reliable.
Okay.
And that's what we need, especially if you have an offense this good.
Yes.
Just reliable. Yes. Don't screw up. Per The Athletic, the pick the Senators are sending to Miami is top 19 protected. And if the Senators
common thing in soccer? Or is this like maybe the first time it's ever happened? Because I saw that and I was like, wow, this feels
very NBA.
NBA, yeah. Right? Like,
I mean, it's interesting that they referred to it as a conditional pick, because conditional is usually like, well, if Roman Torres starts X number of games, you get this pick. Or
I mean, it is a conditional pick.
I mean, yes, but in the NBA, they don't call those conditional picks. They call them protected picks. So
You're gonna have to teach MLS a thing or two about how to phrase these.
You're damned right I am. I still have to teach some people at the NBA how to phrase this stuff. So we're still working on it. Otherwise, it becomes a 2022 second rounder. But looking at where the Sounders are, I don't know where they are in the draft standings right now off the top of my head. But I got to assume it's outside the top 19 because there's 50 teams.
I was gonna say, there's like 40 teams. Every C and D market in the United States has a soccer team now.
Not quite. There are 26 teams. I think they're projected to finish about third or fourth.
They're also projected to be at 45 by 2022.
So they're probably going to convey the pick is what I'm telling you here.
That's fine, though.
Torres had fallen out of favor with new Miami coach Diego Alonso. Must undergo quarantine before joining the team. Most likely in time for the October 7th match.
Have the Sounders done much of anything? Because my impression is that draft picks don't really mean all that much in MLS.
Well, they once drafted a man in the first round, and that name's man was Christian Roldan. But since then, yes, they have not been. Especially as the league expands, they become a lesser figure, you know, less important. And as the league places more emphasis on academies and homegrown players, which is something the Sounders have done a lot of.
Yeah, so what is the difference between those? Like, what players are eligible to go to an academy and which players are eligible to be drafted?
I mean, anyone's eligible to go to an academy. It's just basically your choice.
So sometimes a player might choose to go to the draft? Like, what would be... Why would you ever go through the draft?
Well, if you remain at your local high school and come up that way and go to college, then you would, and you can play college while being part of the academy. We've seen that, obviously. Jordan Morris, Trey Muse, the goalkeeper that the Sounders signed as a homegrown product a couple years ago.
And so Jordan Morris was an academy player. They didn't draft him.
Correct. And they signed him out of Stanford, you know, before he was eligible for the draft. So, and then also, I think late bloomers are more likely to go through the draft process. I'm sure there are still players in the draft. I haven't paid super close attention to the MLS Super Draft lately, but...
Since Nick Bisanio was drafted.
Oh, that was the day. That was the time. The Sounders at home on Sunday against, or on Saturday, I should say, against the Vancouver Whitecaps, who come in the lowest rated team in MLS by Soccer Power Index. They lost 6-0 to LAFC last Wednesday and 1-0 in their home match against the Timbers in Portland on Sunday. The Sounders, you'll recall, get a 3-0 win over the shorthanded Vancouver team during the MLS's back tournament when they didn't have several of their key players.
Now, and again, to understand this, Vancouver is staying permanently in Portland, right?
I think that's their home base, yes.
I feel like these players just want the season to be over with.
You would think. Can't be real great for them. Oh, boy. OL Reign kicked off the NWSL Fall Series on Saturday with a 2-2 draw at Utah Royals FC. All four goals came in the first 38 minutes of this match. The Royals scored the first two goals before Bethany Balser and Rosie White equalized for OL Reign. The Reign will finally make up the game just delayed twice due to smoke on Wednesday against the Portland Thorns in Portland.
Did you hear that more smoke's coming?
I did. I don't anticipate it'll be significant enough to cancel this match, but yes, not ideal. You'll recall that Portland beat Utah 3-0 the previous weekend in the Thorns' only Fall Series game to date. So by the transitive property, the Thorns will win this one, as it turns out. Let's talk about the Seattle Storm, who are on to the WNBA Finals. A toast to that. We should have put that in the toast. An 89-79 win game two on Thursday versus Minnesota, and then a 92-71 win on Sunday to close out the sweep. And then they had to spend a couple days just relaxing. I saw they were out on the boat on Monday. Before figuring out their finals opponent on Tuesday night, as the Aces and Connecticut Sun played the deciding game five of their series, and Las Vegas came from down 6 at halftime, held the Connecticut Sun to just 18 points in the second half of a 66-63 win to set up a meeting of the top two teams in the WNBA in the finals.
This is going to be awesome, right? This is what we've been waiting for.
Yeah, very much so.
This is like clearly the two best teams in all of the WNBA. You know, the young, exciting upstart Las Vegas Aces, new to their city, and then kind of the stalwarts, the Seattle Storm, being
and new to this level of competition.
For the Aces, yeah. And the Storm being anchored by, you know, their almost two-decade tenure vet Sue Bird, Breonna Stewart, who is a veteran in the league, has won MVPs. Like, this is the old vanguard versus the young guns.
It's remarkable how quickly that happens, given how young the Storm team seemed in 2018 when they won their first championship for this group, but the third in franchise history. It is the second trip to the finals in franchise history for the Aces, who went in 2008, well, in San Antonio, with Storm head coach Dan Hughes at the helm at that point. And I, oddly enough, lost to Detroit in that series, who was coached by current Las Vegas coach Billy Bear.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. It was much more of a surprise that Vegas went 18-4 as compared to the Storm during the regular season, though they reached the semifinals.
I mean, there were questions about the Storm going into the year. Like,
no, it was very clear they were going to be the class of the league.
But they still had Stewie hadn't played a WNBA game for a year. Sue was coming off of a long-term injury. Like, there were questions going into the season.
There were questions, but not as significant as Las Vegas, who lost Liz Cambage, who received a medical exemption for the 2020 season, their star player. They also lost Kelsey Plum to an Achilles rupture. But Asia Wilson stepped into a larger role primarily, but playing a lot more center with Cambage's departure, became the MVP of the league. And then they got a huge addition with WNBA legend Angel McCautry, who is facing the Storm for the second time in the WNBA Finals a decade apart.
Wow.
In 2010 in Atlanta, when the Storm swept that series, played against McCautry, who has been to the finals a couple times and not yet won a championship, but she posted the most efficient season of her career this year, playing limited minutes for Las Vegas during the regular season. And the unconventional Aces finished last in the WNBA in three-pointers with 37 fewer than any other team in a 22-game season.
Wow.
And 118 fewer three-point attempts than any other team.
Daryl
Morey
is disgusted.
I mean, it's like watching this Aces Sun game in particular, it was like neither team could make a three. Connecticut went, I think they were 3 of 18 at one when I saw the graphic.
Has the spacing movement hit the WNBA in the same way that it has the NBA?
No, in as much as the WNBA, because their 3-point line was closer, has been able to keep moving it back and making threes more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you would have said the last couple of seasons, the best shooting team in the league won the championship in the Storm in 2018. And then Washington last year was even a level, I think, beyond that. And then this year it's kind of flipped because Las Vegas is playing, like, they're playing Bad Boys Pistons style some three decades after the Bad Boys Pistons last won.
This is kind of awesome.
It's going to be a fun stylistic matchup. I mean, Las Vegas attempted 51 more free throws than anyone else in the league and had the second lowest turnover rate. So they still finished second in offensive rating behind the Storm in the league, despite the lack of threes. They were also second in defensive rating behind the Storm, largely because of their excellent defensive rebounding and rarely fouling. The Aces swept the two regular season matchups with the Storm to claim the number one seed by virtue of head-to-head tiebreaker. Super did not play in either of those two games. The Aces, I would say, still showed matchup problems in the first of the two games, dominating the interior. They outscored the Storm 20-11 at the free throw line and held Breonna Stewart to 10 of 25 shooting and Jewel Lloyd to 1 of 11 shooting as the Storm shot 27% on threes in that matchup. And then they played again in a game that was postponed by the Wildcat strike to the final day of the regular season. Neither Bird nor Stewart played in that one, but the Storm still led most of the way. It was an encouraging performance. They were playing against a Vegas team that was playing a back-to-back, completing that, and got limited minutes from McCautry as they were saving her from the playoffs. But Jewel Lloyd had 30 points in that one, the kind of performance you're going to want to see from her in this series.
Scoring 30 points?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
It is a slightly different Las Vegas team. They lost Sixth Woman Award winner De'Erica Hamby to a knee sprain during the WNBA semifinals that will likely rule her out for this series, almost certainly. And without Hamby, Laimbeer tightened his bench against Connecticut, including playing reserves just 24 total minutes in Game 5, playing Asia Wilson the full 40. So they'll have a relatively quick turnaround. They're 2 days off before Game 1 of the series on Friday, while the Storm has a full 4 days off. They do still have last year's number one overall pick, Jackie Young, coming off the bench, and will probably use her more in the finals in place of starting center Carolyn Swords, a former Storm player who played 31 minutes and was really pretty crucial in Game 5 against Connecticut, but I think may struggle to keep up with the Storm's speed and quickness. And the Storm did suffer a hit to their bench, as they announced on Tuesday that they will be in this series without guard Sammy Whitcomb, another UW legend who's playing at home, who left the bubble to return to Australia for the birth of her first child with wife Kate. Whitcomb has seen action in all 25 games this season for the Storm, including 32 total minutes in the semifinals win over Minnesota. And if you recall back to the 2018 finals, she was on the court in the fourth quarter of the final game of that series in place of Joel Lloyd.
So, I mean, that's a big loss for their for the shooting in general. And spacing against a team that wants to pack it in a little bit more.
It'll make Epiphany Prince, I think, more important in this series. She played quite well against Vegas in the final game of the regular season with Bird and Stewart out, and then got some good minutes in Game 3 against Minnesota, but hadn't played a ton in that series. And then we'll also see just how much Gary Kloppenburg tightens up his rotation. He hasn't needed to. Like, a lot in that semifinal series against Minnesota, they would put five reserves on the court. And you probably don't want to do that at this point.
No. Now, is this a five-game series or
it
seven?
It is, yes. Best of five.
So, I mean, it feels like the Storm have the edge here, both because they're probably a better team than the Aces. They're a little bit healthier. But then also, having those extra days, if you have one game in such a short series where you have an advantage, that's huge.
Yep. I mean, I mentioned that they had identical records. The Storm did have a much better point differential over the course of the season. They did look like the better team, but I agree, combine that with the other factors you mentioned, and really kind of remarkable, because the Storm started their series, again, 2 days late because of the scare of the inconclusive COVID test they had ahead of Game 1 of the semifinals. So to start the series late and finish it two days earlier was a pretty good result for them.
Slugs on my beer. Two slugs. How did that even happen?
Good God. I don't know how that happened. Should I check my beer for slugs?
It was on this piece of wood.
Should we do a percentage chance of victory here?
Should for the series?
Yeah.
It feels pretty overwhelmingly Storm to me.
I'd go about 85%, I think, going.
Wow. Okay.
Is that higher than you were thinking?
I mean, I guess I just don't know enough about the situation to know what. To me, I was like, well, it feels like it's probably like a 75% chance. But at the same time, it also, I feel like they're fairly confident that they're going to win. So 85 seems great.
Let's talk UW Sports, which are back officially. We expected when we podcasted last week that they would be soon, but the Pac-12 CEO group officially voted to resume football and winter sports on Thursday, just after we released that. A 7-game football season will begin November 7th with all teams, as we mused, in action the weekend of the championship game, which will be held on Friday, December 18th. The men's and women's basketball seasons will begin on the official Division I start date of November 25th.
Now, do we know who these 7 games are going to be against?
We do not. It's expected we'll hear that this week.
Okay. So basically, the expectation is that they're going to play the entire North.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, that is certain. Yes, they will play the entire North and then one team from the South.
Two teams.
Well, the second team will be determined by where you finish. That's the crossover game on the weekend of the championship game. So first place first, second place second, and so on.
Well, and so with a situation like that, I mean, like, the normally there's strength of schedule isn't really that big of a factor in college football, or at least within conference play.
Right.
Most teams end up playing basically the entire conference. Matters a little, but
you have some luck in terms of who you miss in the South.
But this is a total crapshoot, right?
Yes, like, it's going to even out less if it's only one team. If you get, I mean, I'm not sure who the weakest of these teams is off the top of my head.
It's a little tough because, again, we don't. It's hard to know going into a season. There's no clear team in the South, especially given the losses that a team like Utah had. You assume that USC
had some opt-outs.
You assume that USC is still the best team in the South.
Yeah.
And then aside from that, it's kind of just like, who are they? Where do you play them?
We'll see how Chip Kelly goes this year.
Right? Like, I mean, that I think UCLA is one where that would be one you'd be hoping for, I suppose. UCLA, Colorado, somebody like that.
Not a great trip for the Huskies last year. I can vouch to that.
But and again, at the same time, like if you have to travel to Colorado, it's that much more difficult, that trip itself.
Right.
So pretty fascinating to see who that extra game is going to be
against. The other thing, by the way, that we haven't talked about is like we're playing the season much later. If you're going to travel to Colorado or Salt Lake City, the Apple Cup is going to be played under some pretty bad weather conditions, it seems likely.
Is it that? I guess it is. Later, it'll be well into December that they're playing these games.
I mean, the Apple Cup will be played December 11th or 12th.
So we're looking at like 3 weeks later than normal, and already had a snowy Apple Cup 2 years ago.
Often, people will recall the 1992 Apple Cup is notably snowy.
Man, this is going to be a crazy season.
Also, if we ever get to remember in the 2000 Apple Cup, it was at least cold. I don't know if it snowed that much.
It is going to be a pretty wild season, though. I mean, you think of it, and it's basically, you know, the last 6 weeks of the NFL season, things start to get a little bit hairy weather-wise. You'll all of a sudden see games where there's feet of snow on the ground, stuff like that. Like, it wouldn't, and it's something that you don't see all that often in college, because they do wrap things up a little bit earlier.
But particularly in a conference like the Pac-12, where you have such wildly different climates within the conference.
Yes.
Like, in the Big Ten, it's probably all pretty similar. But in the Pac-12, it is. The difference between playing in L.A. in December and in Boulder in December is pretty substantial.
The Pac-12 probably has the biggest difference in climates of any conference, right?
I don't know how you would calculate that exactly, but I would guess so.
But, like, the SEC is basically all the same.
Yeah.
Right? Like, climate-wise, it's all the same. The Big 12, when they had Colorado as a school, Colorado and Nebraska, looked a little bit different, but now they're pretty centralized and much more southern than they used to be. I suppose Kansas might get pretty snowy.
Yeah, and like Mizzou in the SEC, it would be a pretty big difference from playing in Gainesville.
But you have to think, I mean, having Utah, Colorado, and Wazoo in there.
Yeah.
Man, oh, this is going to be a weird season.
It sure is. And the Huskies began full practice for it on Monday. Jimmy Lake on KJR on Tuesday in an interview indicated that all four quarterbacks, backup Jacob Sermon, redshirt freshman Dylan Morris, true freshman Ethan Garbers, and grad transfer Kevin Thompson will battle for the starting job. Here was his quote. All four are going to vie for the starting job here. It started yesterday. It started way back in the offseason. But these last 2 days, we've ramped up our installs. Definitely, as soon as we get into training camp, it's going to be an exciting competition. It's going to be exciting for our team to watch, our coaching staff to watch, and I know for you all to watch and our fans to watch. Whoever shows that they can run our scheme, can lead our offense, make smart decisions, and make plays is going to be the one that's going to be our starter. The starter, I should say. They've got to do it, and they've got to be consistent, and we're looking forward to watching that competition.
Wow. I mean, I think it was Baby Fantasy Genius was asking me who the quarterback would be this year. And I was like, I don't know.
I would be interested to see, like, if there are betting odds for this, who actually is the favorite, because I don't have a good feel for it.
This is the most wide open that the Husky quarterback competition has been, maybe in our history of paying attention to it.
I mean, especially because of the fact that you've got a new offensive coordinator. I mean, technically, you've got a new head coach, but... you know, continuity there, but a new...
Can you remind me who new offensive coordinator is?
His last name is Donovan.
Okay.
John Donovan? I'd have to look that up.
It was just like...
That's why I didn't say it.
When this search was happening, I remember they were talking about all these offensive coordinators, right? There were so many things that happened with this college football season where we kind of just... Our brains just told us to forget them.
I mean, it's been a really long time.
Right? Like, where's Kevin Thompson transferring from again?
Sacramento State. That one I know.
Sac State. There we go.
Hornets? I think Hornets.
John Donovan sounds right to me. I kind of remember that. Right? Because there are all these hot offensive coordinators out there. And
yes, it is John Donovan.
The Huskies ended up getting none of them.
Well, we'll see.
And I recall being slightly disappointed in the hiring of John Donovan back when I thought there would be a college football season at some point.
I mean, there is going to be a college football season at some point. I will say, by the way, I do want to note this. We saw today, as we're recording this, that the Titans have an outbreak in the NFL. And some of the reporting around the Pac-12's adding rapid testing from the Quidel Corporation to make this season possible indicated that it would guarantee, having testing every day would guarantee that no infectious player would play against another team. And what happened in the NFL is a good reminder that testing every day is not a guarantee of that, because you can test negative and still be infectious.
There's no such thing as a guarantee.
I think it's a reasonable mitigation of risk, but it's not a guarantee, and I hope that players don't think that it is. I very much hope that.
Yeah, I mean, we'll keep monitoring the situation as it goes on. The Pac-12 is doing their damnedest, it feels like, and it feels like they're doing more than almost any other conferences to really attempt to make this happen responsibly and sustainably for the student athletes. I mean, you see this outbreak that's happening.
You'll use the SA term for the players.
The players, the SA term, the SA word.
Mom, baby fantasy genius called me the SA word.
I mean, seeing what happened at Notre Dame recently, did Notre Dame already have a large breakout?
I think they did within the campus in general, not within the football team necessarily.
And now, shockingly, it spread to the football team. People from the campus intermingled with people from the football team.
What are the odds?
I mean,
look, if you have a president who's taking it as seriously as Notre Dame's president was over the weekend, I don't know how this would possibly happen. With leadership like that, what could go wrong? I don't know. Well, speaking of Notre Dame, by the way, we're going to get to them in a second here.
Are we really?
Because I don't know how long we're going to continue this. Let's remember a season conceit. But we definitely got to talk about this next game for the Huskies. Week 6 versus number 23, Oregon State.
Okay.
We're going back to 2000 with the Huskies, if the listener recalls. And it was year 2 in Corvallis for Dennis Erickson, immediately following his tenure with the Seahawks. The 7 wins he led the Beavers to in 1999 were their most since 1968.
Wow.
And their first bowl appearance since 1964.
No.
Yes.
They didn't go to a bowl game from 1964 to the year 2000?
I think the bowl game was played in 99. The 5 wins they had.
How is that possible?
Oregon State football is how that was possible. You didn't know this?
That is so long. At the time, not everybody went to a bowl game.
Can I give you the next step? So the previous year before Dennis Erickson arrived, don't look at it, don't spoil it. They had won 5 games under Mike Riley, who then got the Chargers job on the strength of that.
Five games.
That was the most they'd won since 1971.
Oh, my God.
They were so bad for so long.
I feel like I kind of don't remember that because, I mean, it's not like they're a good team when I was growing up. But, like, Oregon State they were a fairly competitive team quite often for, like, a decade around this time period.
Starting in the late 90s. Mike Riley team started it. Including in 98, I think they took the Huskies to overtime. But when they came to Seattle in 2000, they had not beat the Huskies since 1985 when they pulled off what was at the time the greatest upset in the history of college football in terms of point spread, a 38-point upset over that Huskies team. Jonathan Smith was entering his second full season as the starting quarterback. Yes, of course, that Jonathan Smith. Mm-hmm. Ken Simonton was on his way to his third consecutive 1,000-yard season as a running back, and they had added some JC transfer named Jad Johnson to a receiver core led by TJ Hushmanzada.
I mean, there was real talent on this team.
Oh, I mean, that offense was pretty potent. Although, let me tell you, Jonathan Smith's completion percentages, you thought Marcus Tuiasosopo's were low.
God.
Jonathan Smith's were even lower. It was a different time in college football. After beating Eastern 21-19 in their season opener, the Beavers had started 4-0, capped by a 31-21 win over number 8 USC in their previous game that had earned their first ranking since 1968. So how this game went? The teams traded touchdowns in the first half. A pair of John Anderson field goals gave the Huskies the 20-14 halftime lead. Oregon State reclaimed the lead on a TJ Hushmanzada TD at the 4:29 mark of the third quarter. The Huskies then went up 26-21 on a Rich Alexis touchdown run in the first minute of the final quarter, but Tui fumbled away the two-point try, and the Beavers returned the conversion for a rare defensive two-point score to make it 26-23. Tui then extended the lead to 33-23 with a four-yard touchdown run. The Beavers answered with an 80-yard Chad Johnson touchdown with 7:22 remaining. The Beavers then got the ball back. They took it over at their own 26 with 4:55 left in the game and down three, and drove to the UW 28 before stalling out and settling for a 46-yard Ryan Cheska field goal with 14 seconds left. The kick was wide right, and the Huskies escaped with the win. Do you remember this game?
Not at all, no.
My memory of it is that we were at our aunt and uncle's house celebrating our Uncle Bob's birthday for this game.
I have no recollection of that.
Okay.
I don't remember anything about this game. I mean, looking back on it, it's like, wow, TJ Hushmanzada and Chad Johnson scored touchdowns.
Yes. That receiving core was fearsome.
It's sort of like one of those Stanford games where you're like, wait, Richard Sherman got a touchdown against the Huskies, yeah. Right? Like they played Richard Sherman and Doug Baldwin, and you don't know until you know.
You really don't. Future Seahawks legend TJ Hushmanzada. This will be a tough one to recall for a young Zach Whitman, who was a diehard Beaver fan at the time, as I remember it, before going to UW.
Diehard Beaver fan.
Yeah. So how the rest of the season went, the Beavers won out. We'll talk about one of their games later, assuming we continue the series, but capped it with a 41-9 demolition
we
of number 10.
We should do like the week before the regular season, just do all the rest of the games.
Yeah, we'll figure out exactly how to do it sequentially. But they demolished number 10 Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl to cap probably the greatest day in modern Pac-10. I guess they did win some national championships with this guy named Pete Carroll at USC, but they won two games in the BCS on the same day on New Year's Day in 2001.
That was huge. There were bigger Pac-12 days since then, but yes.
It was the best season in school history at 11-1. And there's a bunch of articles when I search for this game online where Oregon State fans ask, what if they had won this game? Could they have won the national championship in 2000?
That is incredible. So really, the Huskies were the team that stood in... Who played the national championship this year?
Florida State and Oklahoma. We'll talk about this later. But there were three teams that won, that lost only one time, and they all lost two teams that lost to them. Miami. It's Miami, UW, and Oregon State.
Those are the only teams that lost one time.
I mean, UW lost to Oregon, which I guess is outside this group. But
yeah.
Yes.
But so there are three teams who lost one time. Miami lost to UW.
Yes.
UW lost to Oregon.
Oregon lost to Oregon State.
Oregon lost to Oregon State.
And Oregon State lost to UW.
That if UW beat Oregon in that game last week, they possibly could have played in the national championship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you didn't realize that? Wait, you weren't aware of that?
I mean, I don't know if this team was good enough to have played in the national championship.
Wait, did I say? Oh, Florida State had only lost to Miami, by the way. There were four teams that only lost one time.
Florida State lost to Miami.
Yes.
So if any of those teams, if either of the Pac-12 teams would have won their game, they almost certainly were going.
Yes. So, I mean, this is the, you know, the Pac-12, and even back in the Pac-10 days, the history of eating their own.
Where did Oregon State finish overall?
Let's see. Did they finish number 6, I want to say?
And they throttled Notre Dame in that game.
They just destroyed them. I remember, because we had watched the Husky game previously, the Rose Bowl previously, at our grandparents' house.
Yeah, I remember it was later that night.
Yep, and watching it in, like, their back bedroom. And, yeah, that was just no competition whatsoever. Well, the Huskies finished third in the AP final AP poll, so Oregon State finished fourth.
But again, this was... There was a solid decade plus maybe a hair that Oregon State just kind of was consistently competitive.
Which, given everything else that has happened on either end of it, is really amazing.
Well, and always had players where you're like, wait, that person went to Oregon State? Steven Jackson, right? Like, yep. had a lot of NFL talent for
Derek
that period.
Anderson?
Of time. Who was that?
Derek Anderson?
Yeah.
Not that Derek Anderson. Should we talk about the Seahawks? I guess again, because we already talked about Jermaine Kearse, but if you haven't already checked it out, be sure to listen to our recap podcast of the Seahawks 38-31 win on Sunday against the Dallas Cowboys, in which a lot happened. One of the things that happened were a number of injuries, but the Seahawks seem to have escaped serious injuries there. They will likely be without Jamal Adams, Chris Carson, and Jordan Brooks for some period of time. Pete Carroll shared on his show on ESPN Seattle on Monday that all of those injuries are first-degree sprains/strains, which is the least severe version. It's like the it's the opposite of DEFCON 1.
Kind of incredible that every injury was like, okay, all right.
Yeah, it's like it could have been so much worse.
Okay. I mean, Jamal Adams is the one, like, no offense to Chris Carson, but, you know, there are other running backs who can do what Chris Carson does. There's nobody else on this team available in free agency, available for trades, anywhere on earth that can do what Jamal Adams does and what the Seahawks need him to do.
To save their defense. In addition to that, Damian Lewis suffered an ankle sprain and sounds like he might be able to play this week. So that's even more encouraging news on that front. Another big Seahawks development.
Yes.
ESPN on Tuesday released the update of their pass rush and pass block win rates and run block and run stuff. Win rates. The Seahawks are number 5 in the NFL in pass block win rate. Let that sink in. Jordan Simmons, number 2 among guards.
Look at Jordan Simmons.
Very effective play in place of Damian Lewis in that one.
I was really wondering about this. Just thinking about causation through this time period and basically what leads to what.
Love to think about causation.
Right? And it's hard for me not to come back to Russell Wilson all the time. And that if Russell Wilson is cooking, they're a hard team to pass rush, right? There's so much other stuff that goes into it that you can't really pass rush in the same way that you'd like to.
A lot of teams have been able to pass rush.
Russell Wilson has never cooked like he's cooking right now.
I mean, the one thing I haven't been under the hood of this metric enough, and I really probably have the ability to do so,
you and ESPN celebrity Zach Whitman, they share this with him. Yes.
I don't know how much it adjusts for situations, so the fact that the Seahawks are passing in more favorable passing situations.
That too, for sure.
Like, Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin had a tweet about their percentage of passes on first and second down on Tuesday, and I think it had gone from 69% in 2018, which was not nice, to 73% last season and 77% this season. And by the way, it seemed like it was about 20% in 2018. I'm surprised it was
0%. Only when forced to. Only when they got a holding on the real first down on a run. And then they had to pass on first and 20. And only in those situations did they do it 20% of the time. Let's talk about... I've got a couple of topics to come back to later, but...
I've got one more thing to get to before we talk about Miami.
Yeah.
Which is wide receiver snap counts. I mentioned this at some point in some podcast, but I'm not sure when.
Last week.
But I was not quantifying at that point. And I was able to use Pro Football Reference's snap counts to go across the entire league. The wide receivers who are playing the most snaps as a percentage of their team snaps. Number 1 is Keenan Allen of the Chargers at 99.1%. Number 2 is DK Metcalf at 98%.
DK.
Number 3 is Tyler Lockett at 95.6%.
DK couldn't run a route.
There were only 10 guys in
all
the entire league.
All he does is run straight.
Who have played more than 90% of their snaps. The Seahawks have 2 who are over 95%.
That is wild.
So they may free Josh Gordon, I guess is what I'm saying.
I mean, when Josh Gordon is freed, it is going to come at the exact right time.
I sure hope so.
Because whenever that happens, they need him badly. And, you know, clearly it shows that I just don't think they feel great about David Moore. Because you mentioned wide receiver snap counts and how much they're playing. But I also, was it Freddie Swain outsnapped DJ Moore this week?
That is correct.
DJ Moore, David Moore.
we were talking about DJ Moore earlier. I think Bob Condotta noted that, yes.
But yeah, Freddie Swain outsnapping David Moore. Like, they don't feel good about David Moore as the third receiver.
They could feel a lot better about someone else. Lastly, I wanted to mention the opponents that Russell Wilson has not beaten on the road. Okay. All of which I think he's played only one time. Maybe there's one team. No, I don't think he's played any of these teams twice.
On the road.
Yes. He's beaten most of these opponents, period. I forget what the list is down to in terms of opponents he hasn't beaten. But Cincinnati, Denver, Indianapolis, Jacksonville, Kansas City, LA Chargers, Miami, New Orleans, Tampa Bay, and Tennessee. And so what's notable about this is this is the first time in Russell Wilson's career that he's coming back to the same AFC road location because it's an 8-year cycle, basically.
Yep. And we remember the first time he played at Miami.
It was after
Thanksgiving. It was post-Thanksgiving.
It was post-Thanksgiving.
And it was freaking devastating that they lost this
game.
Now
I'm trying to remember
what
happened
in the
Apple Cup.
It was the week
before,
I think, they played Chicago.
Correct.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what happened in the Apple Cup because I think it was like a bad Seattle sports weekend. I think that might have been the Nick Folk missed field goal loss overtime.
You might have said that it was the best weekend in Seattle sports history.
Oh, come on. We're still on this thing. So this is the only chance this season that Russell Wilson has to knock one of these teams off the list.
Not that that really matters, but...
I'm just pointing it out.
Are there any teams that Russell Wilson just straight up has not beaten?
He has definitely not beaten the Chargers. Because they beat the Seahawks in Seattle.
They won last year, right? No.
Not last year. I think it was 2 years ago. It was last year. I don't know. First off, all the years run together now because they were all in the before times. But I know I was about to go to the Sounders-Timbers match, and I'm pretty sure that was last fall.
And you're just like,
no, that was two falls ago because the Sounders lost to the Timbers. They won the MLS Cup last year, so it was 2018. Yeah, we've worked it out. Yeah, Phil Rivers had the Seahawks number.
He's never beaten the Chargers.
I mean, it's only been two times. It's not like it's like...
It was just that one game in like week two, 2000...
Yes, where
whatever.
Phillip Rivers completed like literally every third down pass. It felt like a current Seahawks game.
God. So my questions for you as sort of general overarching questions. Coming back to last week's game, the Gator rule that Tristan Hill had.
You know, people named Tristan.
On Chris Carson. Look, Tristan Wirfs is excelling.
Is Tristan Hill spelled with an E?
It's with a Y.
Oh, okay.
T-R-Y-S-T-E-N. Look, I'm paying attention to this sort of thing. Tristan Wirfs, however, spells it the exact same way as me, and he's doing great protecting Tom Brady. But how upset are we about this play?
The Seahawks players and coaches are upset, so, you know, therefore I support them in their thinking. I don't know that I myself have lost a lot of sleep over it.
Do you feel like it warrants a suspension?
I think it's tough for the NFL to start legislating intent there.
Do you think if there was a play where you can reasonably judge intent, and if the intent is to specifically injure somebody?
I mean, the only time, like, other than... Obviously, they've made rules to take away targeting, and players have been suspended for that. But other than that, the only time that players have been suspended for like something like this would probably be Bountygate, right? Like, there's actually like written proof of it.
Uh huh. I don't know. This one to me feels worse than a targeting penalty. Like,
I think it probably is in the fact that it's not like a split second decision.
Yeah, and it happens within the flow of play. Like,
again, I'm speaking from the NFL's standpoint.
Somebody puts their head down a little bit and it's a helmet-to-helmet hit. This was... When you watch this play, it's hard to understand that it could be anything but the intent to injure.
I was told by Mike McCarthy it wasn't.
Reliable source.
Objective.
Okay.
I don't know.
Secondly, do you feel like defenses are going to start adjusting to the Let Russ Cook era?
In what way?
Preparing for the Seahawks to pass the ball. And in particular, preparing for the Seahawks to pass the ball on early downs.
I don't know the teams since Atlanta have necessarily not been doing that. It just, like... Players are conditioned by decades of playing football to believe in play action, so that's not something you can game plan for. I mean, maybe you start playing a lot more nickel and dime in those situations, I guess, but I don't know that makes that big of a difference.
That was a question that I had, where it's like, I feel like the ideas people like, the let Russ cook idea is just Russ passes more, which I don't think it's as simple as that.
It's not as simple as that, but yes, it's not like when Russ passes on 3rd and 10, that's an example of letting Russ cook. Like, no, it's when he passes on 2nd and 10, guys.
I mean, I think of the times, like, you know, you always look at the, and the Chiefs have done this too in the Mahomes era, but, you know, Brady is like the best at it, where it's like, if they give you a front that you could run on, just freaking run. Like,
no, I mean,
take what the defense is giving you. If
that's
there's
interesting this week.
I mean, I'm fascinated to discuss the Dolphins because they are a unique team. But if there's a situation,
is unique a euphemism in this case?
What?
Well, they're bad defensively. They're just bad.
But they're bad in multiple different ways. But I'm saying, if there is a situation that the Dolphins or that any team is like, run on us, do it. Seahawks, like, we are going to stop Russell Wilson. We're going to force you to run the ball. Are we comfortable with the Seahawks having a game that they run heavily?
I think you said this, I don't know if it was on Sunday or last week's pod, but the idea is not that the Seahawks can never run. The idea is don't run in situations that are unfavorable to run.
Or that you're expected to run.
Which, in general, like, running is less effective than passing. But if you can run for 5 yards a carry, you should probably run a pretty good amount of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they might be able to do that this week.
Great. Okay, before we talk about the Dolphins, let me ask you a question. DVOA-wise, where do you think, have you looked at this? The Seahawks defense ranks this season as opposed to last season.
I've looked at where they rank this season. I don't necessarily remember where they ranked last season, but I assume it probably isn't that much worse.
They currently are 23rd defensive DVOA this year.
Correct.
And last season they finished 21st in defensive DVOA. And I feel like there's a dialogue about this defense. It's like,
well,
they can't get a stop or whatever. And this is not opponent adjusted, where, like, even if you adjust for an opponent, like, the Seahawks have played fairly strong, at least offensive opponents. If once this is opponent adjusted, they could be higher than 21st.
That is plausible. I mean, part of it is just nobody can stop anybody right now.
Throughout the league.
In part because of the fact that holding isn't a thing anymore, which I endorse, but is definitely making life very difficult for defenses.
Holding sucks.
It's the worst.
Right?
It's way too harsh a penalty. My colleague Brian Burke had a thing last year that because of the fact that offenses are so opponent, these penalties need to be less severe. And I think that, or more severe, I should say. And I think that it was actually the opposite, is that they were way too severe in the past.
Let people score. It's fun.
I mean, I enjoyed that Chiefs-Ravens game. I don't know about you.
Did you?
Well, okay.
It wasn't really that good of a game.
I enjoyed when the Chiefs had the football during the Chiefs-Ravens game.
In the first half. It was a fun first half. This wasn't Chiefs-Rams from two seasons ago.
No, it wasn't that.
Or because whatever.
The Ravens just couldn't keep up for a long period of time. Beyond that, I mean, they've got four interceptions through three games. So that's probably a pretty big factor in that. And I don't know if that's a sustainable factor. Like, we've seen that those come and they go.
They have neither been super lucky nor unlucky. But I wouldn't be shocked if they were at or maybe even a little bit better than the level that they were at prior years. And I think they're being judged a little bit too harshly for that. And speaking of defenses who are not playing well.
The Miami Dolphins, who got their first win on Thursday, dominating Jacksonville 31-13 in a Battle of Florida on Thursday Night Football that surely outrated the NBA game that night. The Dolphins suffered competitive losses their first 2 weeks, 21-11 at New England and then 31-28 in their home opener against Buffalo, delayed by lightning. Is this surely will as well?
Is there really lightning in the forecast?
Well, it's Miami in September. Yeah, of course. I mean, I guess technically it's October, but yeah, of course there's lightning in the forecast.
Oh, God.
Let's just hope it strikes during the period that the Storm Aces game is on and maybe works out well there.
Oh, God. They're playing a game opposite. Ugh.
Yeah, that game starts at game two of that series starts at 12 noon. This
Why?
Game kicks off at 10 a.m. Pacific time.
Why, WNBA?
Pacific Daylight Time.
Oh, It's like they want people not to watch.
Let's not go.
Play the fucking game on Saturday. Just whatever you do, don't compete with the NFL.
I don't know if you're aware of this. There's a lot of college football on the ESPN family of networks on Saturdays. And that drives the decision.
Okay.
The Dolphins' offense hasn't been bad. They're number 15 in offensive DVOA, but their defense ranks dead last.
I think DVOA is kind of wrong on this one.
On their defense or on their offense?
A little bit on both. This is, and even when I look at it statistically, I'm like, I kind of don't see how what's going on here adds up to them having the worst defensive DVOA in the league. They got roasted by Josh Allen, but they played fairly good against Jacksonville. Like, there were some garbage time yards for Gardner Minshew.
They are allowing the most yards per pass attempt of any team in the National Football League so far.
I guess what it is that a lot of the game was garbage time because they scored so efficiently early on against Jacksonville, and they got roasted by Josh Allen.
Garbage time isn't necessarily less predictive. Like, that's the reason why it's incorporated the same in DVOA, because when you incorporate it, it makes your predictions better.
To me, what was interesting, though, is they did an okay job against Cam in week one passing the ball, but couldn't stop the run in week one.
Well, they are worse in terms of rush defensive DVOA, where they rank number 31 in that one and are allowing 4.9 yards per carry. By the way, this is an improvement for them so far. The last place on last year when they had the sixth worst DVOA defensively on record.
But yeah, so they gave up 217 rushing yards to the Patriots in week one, and then 411 passing yards in week two. And then they kind of just, they reined things in a little bit against Jacksonville in week three, which, who knows what happened, right? It's Jacksonville. Jacksonville possibly could be the worst team in the league.
Minshew was playing pretty well the first couple of weeks, but yeah, it does feel a little bit like the finger is plugging the different holes, but they don't have enough fingers.
But this is one where I don't look at it and say to myself, this is clearly the worst defense in the league. And on the flip side, I mean,
they started as the sixth worst defense in NFL, in the DVOA era last year. There's a lot of room for them to improve and still be very bad.
On the flip side, feels like this is kind of better than the 15th best offense.
I do agree with that. Ryan Fitzpatrick ranks ninth in Dakota. He is, which has allowed him to maintain his job at age 37, despite the Dolphins taking Tua Tagovailoa with the number 5 overall pick in this year's draft.
It's been 3 weeks.
Fitz is good, man.
Oh, Fitz is good.
He threw 3 picks in week one, but was nearly perfect last week. 18 of 24, 160 yards, and 2 touchdowns, while also adding 38 yards on the ground.
Oh, my God.
This man is almost as old as I am.
Can you imagine?
I can't run for 38 yards.
Going to Harvard and then running for 38 yards in an NFL game at your age? People are tweeting Ryan Fitzpatrick.
It's very lucky when I can run for 38 yards and not be chased by NFL players and tackled by them.
I mean, it's incredible. Ryan Fitzpatrick has like one of the most amazing NFL careers.
There really should be a 30 for 30 about Fitzpatrick. I like this stat. This is his 4th career start with the Seahawks, against the Seahawks, I should say, all with different teams.
4 different teams. Okay, I'm going to go through them.
Yeah.
Buffalo.
Yep.
Tampa Bay.
Yes.
New York Jets.
Oh, no, Jets were correct. Tampa Bay was wrong. Jets are correct.
He never started with Tampa Bay against?
Not against the Seahawks.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, because there's another team.
Okay, the Jets. This one. Oh, my God, who else?
They just didn't play the Bucs during that era, I guess.
And then the Dolphins. Who is the 4th Fitzmagic team? Did I say Buffalo?
You said Buffalo. That was the game in Toronto.
I've just gone through all the AFC East.
They all have been since 2012, for the record.
Who is the one that I'm forgetting? Tennessee?
Tennessee, correct. There we during go. 2013.
God, I kind of forgot that he played for Tennessee.
Yeah.
Fitzmagic is just... He's just a pretty good quarterback. But the other thing about Fitzmagic is he is very good in weeks 1 through 3 of an NFL season and does seem like he starts falling off around week 4.
Well, I hope so. Those were very different Seahawks defenses he was playing against in 2012, 2013, and 2016, but he's 0-3 in those games and has completed 56% of his passes against the Seahawks with 7 interceptions and 2 touchdowns.
Yes, we've never really been roasted by Fitzmagic before.
There was maybe a half where they were good, but then the second half came, and yeah.
I mean, he's always come in with a significantly worse team, which is, again, the case in this one as well.
Yeah. The Dolphins have added Matt Breda and Jordan Howard at running back in the last year, but neither of them, has been able to secure the starting running back job because that's gone to a young man named Miles Gaskin. O'Day's finest. UW's finest. Miles Gaskin has averaged 4 yards per carry, which may not sound very good, but last year they finished dead last in rushing DVOA and had maybe the worst yards per carry in NFL history.
Really?
I don't know for sure on that one, but it was really bad.
Who was starting
bad
for them post Kenyon Drake?
Well, Howard started for a while. Then there was the Patrick Laird.
Yeah, Patrick, who's still on the roster.
He's
playing a little bit of, like, I want to call H-back. Maybe I'm just calling him that because he's white, but he was definitely playing some, like, fullback. I mean, I started Miles Gaskin in fantasy last week, so I was watching closely for who was running the ball.
He had 22 carries in that one for a career high 66 yards. Let's go.
And a threat out of for receiving out of the backfield as well.
He's their leading receiver, as a matter of fact, wow, with 15 catches this season.
He's their leading receiver in terms of catches.
I don't know that you want your running back to be your leading receiver, as it turns out.
If we could have another game like what Zeke had last week, sign me up.
Devontae Parker has been pretty good for them at wide receiver this year, catching 82% of his targets for 9.9 yards per target. And their tight end Mike Gesicki is also a threat, which is good for one of my 3 fantasy teams. He's averaged 14.6 yards per catch, second to Mo Alie-Cox among tight ends this season.
Wow, look at Mo Alie-Cox.
Yeah, he's had quite a season. Offensive line ranks number 31 in both pass block and run block win rate, according to ESPN's analytics' metrics.
Oh, free Alton Robinson.
The other note I had is that even though the Dolphins have allowed more yards per attempt than anyone else in the league, the Seahawks have allowed more net yards per attempt than anyone else in the league, and the Dolphins are only 4th worst there because they have 7 sacks thus far, led by 2 from Kyle Van Noy.
Oh, great.
So there you go.
This feels like the poor man's version of Patriots Seahawks, Cowboys Seahawks, right? This is...
You think it's going to be another shootout?
Well, I guess I don't want to say that the Patriots are much better on offense than on defense. I don't know if that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, I have some concerns. I think the Seahawks exposed some issues with their defense due to the opt-outs.
The Seahawks so far this year have played confidently 2 teams that are significantly better on offense than they are on defense, and then the Patriots.
I would agree with that.
And this will be 3rd out of 4 of those games where the Dolphins can move the ball. I don't think anybody questions whether the Dolphins and Ryan Fitzmagic can move the ball. Can they stop the Seahawks at all? And I think that is going to be a more difficult question to ask. But at the same time, like, you know, the being prone to air of Fitzmagic and just the talent overall on the offensive side of the ball, it's not the Cowboys and the Dolphins are not comparable to each other.
If you're drawing up the team you want to play against the Seahawks, a team that is really bad defensively and can make big plays offensively, but is super inconsistent, is probably not the formula you'd want.
I worry, though. Like, I don't go into this game saying, oh, this is easy. And I think people who are approaching this game too overly confident are not being worried enough that it's a bit of a trap game in a lot of ways, right?
I hate the trap game concept, but
it is.
I agree that they're better than they look.
The Dolphins are better than they look. It's an easy game to take for granted. It's still a trip across the country, although the Russell Wilson Seahawks have been quite good at 10 a.m. starts. They've been quite good on the road recently and quite good at 10 a.m. starts. I fear them a little bit less than I would have otherwise getting going. But, like, they're going to have to put up points in this game.
Yeah.
The Seahawks are going to have to score 30 points to win this game.
I guess the Dolphins' yards per carry was not that notably low last year, although Fitz may have been a reason for that. They averaged 3.3 yards per carry.
Scrambling Fitz.
Which was only the second worst since 2000 because it was ahead of the 2016 Minnesota Vikings, who averaged 3.17 yards per carry. So there you go. Or second worst since 2005, I should say.
But this team scares me a little bit. This game scares me a little bit.
I mean, Fitz is a wild card. Like
Fitz,
I said,
Fitz is a wild card. The Dolphins in general are a wild card.
Fitz is a wild card would concern me more if it wasn't a case where I think the Seahawks can just march into the ball up and down against this defense. But
I mean, like the how much better do you think the Seahawks are than the Bills?
I mean, I don't know if I want to give you like a percentage that I think they're better, but it's not dramatically different between those two teams, I would agree.
Assuming that the Seahawks offense is a little bit better than the Bills, and the Seahawks defense is probably
way worse.
But I don't know. Like, the Bills defense, they've got a couple of pretty rough-looking games now in the books, right? They gave up 28 points to the Dolphins, and they let the Rams come roaring back. But, like, maybe this is just what the NFL is going to be this year.
It's very possible.
Like the Bills needed some big plays to beat the Dolphins in that game. It was 31-28. At the same time, like I picture in my head, I guess we weren't together, but watching NFL Red Zone in week two and Josh Allen literally just throwing the ball up and having receivers wide open down the field. And you're telling me that you can replace Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs for one, but then there was somebody else I think who caught a bomb that scored a touchdown, and you're going to replace that with Russell Wilson and Tyler Lockett, or Russell Wilson and DK Metcalf.
I don't feel like you're making the point you're trying to make here.
No, I'm saying that I don't think the Dolphins can stop the Seahawks.
Yeah, I agree.
But they're going to give up some points, and I think this one will be closer than people anticipate, and it could even come down to another last second type drive, you know, where the Dolphins get the ball down 8 or something like that with 2 minutes left.
Yeah, I think that's plausible. But the Bills sure rate much better than the Seahawks this far this season by NFL tiers. Whew. Their offense has been quite good. Well, chances of victory?
73%.
70% I'm going to go with.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so one other point that I want to make is this game is freaking huge in a lot of ways because the stakes in the NFC West are so high.
Correct.
And looking around the NFC West, I would say it's probably, I mean, it's tough to do the schedule game of like this team's going to win that one, this team's going to win that one. I would say it's possibly more likely than not that 3 and maybe 4 NFC West teams are 4-1 heading into week 6. Looking at these schedules in particular, you've got
San Francisco has a backloaded schedule.
The bye week for the first 8 weeks. San Francisco is 2-1, and they have coming up the Eagles and then also the Dolphins in the next 2 weeks. Eagles look like one of the worst teams in the NFL. Dolphins, they're playing that game at home. And
I'm not willing to go that far yet on the Eagles.
The Eagles are fucking bullshit. I hate them. Sunday night football, kill me.
As opposed to that thrilling Minnesota-Seattle game that's staying on Sunday Night Football. I was really hoping it would get flexed.
Do they flex games that early in the season?
They can. Bob Condotta indicated they can. I didn't look to double-check it, but I was hoping it would get flexed because the Sounders play at 4 and the Storm could play. There's an NBA Finals game at 4:30 that day, potentially. So I was like, hey, maybe if we play at 1, well, not so bad.
But, so basically looking at this, the Niners are going to be favored in both those games. Right?
Sure. I don't know that we need to go through this with each individual opponent.
Hold on, though. The Rams, 2-1. Their next two games, Giants and Washington football team.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all of these teams in the NFC West are going to play all of the NFC East teams eventually. So it works out.
And then
I mean, assuming there's not massive outbreaks on some of those teams.
The Cardinals next two are both on the road at Carolina and at the New York Jets. Like, we could have a situation where going into that week six, all of these teams would be in the playoffs if they started that day.
Yeah.
So the stakes are so incredibly high for the Seahawks. They don't have room for error. And they don't have room...
Some people call that margin for error.
They don't have margin for error to lose a game that they should win. So, like, this game against the Dolphins becomes so hugely important. They're going to lose games against the NFC West. It's just, like, there's no doubt in my mind that all of these teams are going to sort of beat up upon each other. But every other game, they have to win to even both confidently make the playoffs and then start considering some of that, the higher tiers of what we're considering right now. Like, the Seahawks are a team who could be competing for a Super Bowl.
I mean, more directly to the point, could be competing for the one bye week that now exists.
Yeah, competing for the West, competing for the one bye week, you know, a home game in the playoffs, whatever the hell that means in 2021.
It definitely still means something.
And then also, you know, you didn't mention this, but bringing in Demaryius Randall for a visit today, still the conversation about bringing in Snacks Harrison, which we haven't mentioned. They're going to have to go out and make some moves.
Probably. I mean, we'll see. I wonder if some of that reporting was before they knew the severity of these injuries. I mean, not that the injuries were on the defensive line.
They brought in Demaryius Randall today.
Yes.
After they knew the severity. Look, I think there's a high likelihood that they signed Demaryius Randall.
If you bring someone in 2020 who's a veteran, you're probably going to sign them. Although the Texans did not sign Earl Thomas, as it turned out.
It's very weird, that story. So, where it was like, oh, he's going to sign with the Texans, and then... I'd still just wonder. I have not put it out of my mind the possibility that the Seahawks could engage with Earl Thomas again.
We can't rule anything out.
But I just, there's something going on with Earl Thomas.
I hope that there is not. So, well, on that note, we have successfully completed a in-person podcast.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
This is Jan calling me.